With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Pelle Nyroth-Taylor, live from Sweden on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome to the Pelle Nyroth-Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon. I've got an announcement to make here. Between the 3rd and the 5th of May in Workington in the UK Lake District, or near it, there is the Weekend Truth Festival, which looks like a kind of Glastonbury for lovers of debate, discussion, truth-seeking, and freedom. Katie Hopkins will be there, so will Kate Shamirani, Dolores Cale, Matt Letizia, Mark Atwood, David Clues, allegedly Dave, and many others. All you need to do is bring your sleeping bag and your good freedom-loving selves. There'll be food stalls, bushcraft, and workshops all available on site, so book your place at weekendtruthfestival.co.uk if you want to meet TNT people in the live. We've got some excellent guests today. Rwanda's in the news, of course, because of its possible destination for asylum seekers. Michaela Wrong, who's a very well-known writer on the topic, talks to us about her books on the murderous regime of Paul Kagame, a leader who's been fated by the British government, but whose investigations into the murders he's carried out has left her screaming at night for fear that she'll be targeted by his assassination squads. Most people remember the Rwanda genocide with him as some kind of hero. Well, that's completely wrong, and it begs the question if we should be sending asylum seekers there. We've got this Gaza conflict, which is having repercussions all over the world. The dozens of bags in Chicago have just been discovered containing anti-Semitic flyers and rat poisoning all over Chicago's Lincoln Park. Lots of people are going a bit crazy in America over this conflict, and we will bring Dr. Carol Lieberman, who's a well-known psychiatrist in America, as our second guest, to what she thinks is the deranged behavior, if there's a kind of terrorist envy of Hamas, which is manifesting itself in sort of pseudo-terroristic acts. We'll also be talking to her about the state of mind, or the mind of the US's presidential candidates and other pathologies in American body politic. Our third guest is Shea Bradley, who'll tell us about Jill Biden's bad policies for women. Here, she's got a new initiative, the First Lady, to fundamentally change women's health. But to what extent will this actually help women? She doesn't seem to be helping. Biden, her husband, is obviously not caring about the women of Ukraine, because he's giving money to send their husbands and sons to their deaths and leaving women as widows or grieving at the best worst case, or even going to combat themselves. And of course, the Biden administration famously thinks men are women. So will Jill Biden really do a lot for women in her women's health initiative, or is it a case of huge double standards? Finally, we've got Matthew Blackburn, a geopolitics researcher, talking about that Ukraine conflict and whether the West needs an effective plan B rather this sort of money going into nothing, corruption scandals, feeding the corruption scandals in Ukraine, where munitions will still be lacking even if the money goes to Ukraine under the New Deal being apparently stitched up with Mike Johnson and Biden. There's a whole realistic thinking. This definition of victory is still lacking. At what point will the West feel Ukraine has achieved the battle position which it will be able to ask for an honorable peace with the Russians? Will that ever happen? I don't think so. But what might happen is an escalation where NATO doubles down and maybe even enters the war. Matthew will tell us about his very clear-minded, realistic position about what the West might do. Anyways, we've got Basil Valentine, our political editor, to talk us through some of the day's events and news after a very quick break. This is the Pelle Nyroth-Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
Abroad or at home, this is your news.
By staying silent, we are part of the problem.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good afternoon, Basil Valentine, political editor. How are you today?
Very well, thank you, Pelle. Great to see you, and hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world.
Good.
Well, Britain is gearing up for a general election, of course, this year, and it's widely expected that the Conservative Party will be all but wiped out. But a report in the Daily Express today says confusion over voter ID laws could end up saving Rishi Sunak at the election, with as many as 5 million voters set to be turned away from the polls. In 2022, the government passed a law requiring Britons to show photo ID to vote, claiming it was needed to prevent electoral fraud. This new rule accepts any one of 22 forms of ID, including passports and several types of bus passes, as well as driving licenses and biometric immigration documents. However, a lack of awareness of the law resulted in more than 14,000 voters being turned away from polling booths in the 2023 local elections. And if that was repeated at the general election, it could prove decisive, according to Best for Britain. Best for Britain's chief executive, Naomi Smith, said, while polls suggest it won't be enough to change the result of the next general election, the introduction of unnecessary photo ID could be the difference between victory and defeat for various high-profile Conservatives in marginal constituencies. And speaking of marginal constituencies, Labour has warned its candidates in non-target constituencies they will be deselected if they don't put enough hours into campaigning in other winnable seats, the so-called battleground seats that will determine the next election. So if you're standing for Labour in a safe Tory seat, you'll get kicked out if you don't travel 50 miles down the road and campaign vigorously for one of your would-be colleagues in the general election.
Well, Basil, do you think, so has election fiddling crossed the Atlantic then? It sounds a bit like, you know, what's happened in the US in 2020 when there's all this kerfuffle and stuff about who's going to be eligible to vote or something. Do you think, so you think it's going to favour the Tories? What's, Daily Express is not always the most reliable. It's a reliable indicator of people's prejudices, but it's not exactly a reliable indicator of what's really going on in the world.
Well, the polls are showing Labour's, you know, set to win a huge majority, in spite of the fact that its membership is cratering, down 25,000 last month alone, and the begging letters are out. It's not the biggest party in Western Europe anymore, which it was under Jeremy Corbyn. And frankly, there is very, very little enthusiasm for a Keir Starmer-led Labour government. There have been all sorts of policy problems, of course, not least over Gaza and also their abandonment of the green agenda, which, for whatever we think of it, is very popular with young voters. So young voters are going to stay at home and not vote Labour. Muslims aren't going to vote Labour. Left-wingers aren't going to vote Labour. They've been kicked out of the party and generally disagree with the whole neoliberal direction of Starmer's Labour Party. There could be a huge fall in turnout, particularly if voters are turned away because they don't have the right type of ID. And then, of course, we've got the two insurgent parties. Reform are polling at 15% and the Tories at 21%. I mean, that's an extraordinary statistic. I'll be amazed if that is reproduced in the general election. And then the Workers' Party, the George Galloway Party, they're looking to field candidates in just about every constituency in the country, believe it or not. So we could be in for some sort of political earthquake. That's what I'm hoping for. With the, you know, the dream would be a hung parliament and Starmer deprived of an overall majority. But since it's Friday, we've got one rather more amusing little anecdote from the upcoming general election. Reform UK, of course, have asked the media to help them vet their candidates. One or two have already been dropped for historic tweets of a racist nature. And there are various organisations like Hope Not Hate, among others, trawling through the Twitter feeds of these candidates, many of whom have never been involved in politics before, looking for anything that they can, you know, find that's outside the acceptable opinion corridor somewhere where one of these gadflies has stepped off the reservation and made a racist remark, so they can then be deselected and reform dragged into the gutter as a result. But this is a particularly amusing way for somebody to be deselected. It was sacked a general election candidate for being inactive. This was a Mr. Corkwell. And in York Central, they dropped Tommy Corkwell after he didn't respond to a number of phone calls and emails. It turned out that, unfortunately, Mr. Corkwell had passed away. So I shouldn't think he was too concerned about... I shouldn't think he was too concerned about his deselection by reform, where he is now.
There's this joke going on in America. There's a film called Weekend at Bernie's, which is about a guy, the hero or the anti-hero, the main protagonist, dies very on in the early in the film. And I can't remember the plot exactly, but the point was he had to be kept pretend alive throughout the entire plot film for some reason or other. So there are people, these pulling him around. He's wearing sunglasses, you know, and he was flopping around like dead people do or whatever. And the conceit was that nobody could tell, you know, but that because the young men who were on either side of him dragging him around were sort of very good at giving the appearance of the dead man Bernie of being sort of alive, you know. So it's quite funny because, you know, he wasn't talking and they kind of compensated that for talking over him and things like that. And of course, there've been drawn comparisons between Weekend at Bernie's and Joe Biden. So yeah, that's quite funny though. I mean, I guess the small parties like that are the recent. It's fun to make the professionalism fun of the lack of professionalism in these parties. I know the guy, Gavin Towler, who used to be. He was on the Sprout when I was writing in Brussels. It's like a private eye of Brussels. I could never have guessed he'd get where he got, you know, an eccentric guy. Nice, though. But he's now saying, well, you know, we're all working in our kitchen tables. I mean, he gave an interview in the Express the other day where he gets the impression of they're really, really underfunded and almost like a comic piece. It's not the sort of thing you'd expect a press officer to do because it kind of really undersells the Reform Party. But maybe they'll get that kind of hoping for that sort of anti-establishment effect, but you got the impression of this is a party really run on a serious shoestring. But
I think they don't have the big backers of the major parties, obviously not. But Farage could inspire 10 Tory MPs to defect to Reform, according to Aaron Banks, the top Brexiteer. And if he did so, with Reform currently polling only a few points behind the Tories, that would be very, very significant indeed. Banks, the co-founder of the Leave.eu campaign.
But when you said, we just got to go into our next guest, but Basil, why do you want to hung Parliament? I don't even know what your political sympathies are, actually.
Voters maybe have been able to work them out from my various prognostications over the months and years. The reason
that's
I want
a good
hung
political journalist, you can't tell. Anyway,
that's right. The reason I want a hung parliament is because I'd like to see electoral reform. I think the two-party system has governed Britain very, very badly for the last 40 plus years. We have effectively an elected dictator governed Britain very, very badly for the last 40 plus years. We have effectively an elected dictatorship, and I'd like to see a much wider range of opinions reflected in the House of Commons. Simple as that.
Certainly, I'd agree with that. So electoral reform and hung parliament. Let's see if we can get that. Okay, we'll have you in the next hour, and we're going over to our first guest after a very quick break. This is the Pelinero-Roth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
TNT's Patrick Henningsen.
Joe Biden's a bit of an anomaly in that respect. Normally, the incumbent is running a lot stronger going into the second term or the re-election bid. That's not the case with Joe Biden. We see a lot of people fleeing from his support base, even from his own party, which is unusual. And there's a lot of good reason for that on the foreign policy side, which we'll be discussing throughout this program, but also domestically as well. They haven't been able to tackle inflation in the United States, and that's a big problem. So this isn't, voters aren't, they're not caring anymore about COVID. They don't care anymore about vaccine mandates. As we've said before, this mainly is going to be, it's going to come down to being three things: gas, groceries, and World War III.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk TNT Radio should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon. We're very pleased to have Michaela Wrong with us again. She's just written a book about Rwanda, rather, it's her most recent book. Rwanda is a hot topic, a perennial hot topic, because Britain wants to turn Rwanda into permanent host nation of asylum seekers who reach UK soil, regardless if they have a connection to Rwanda or not. Seems to have run afoul of European courts at the moment, but we'll see where it goes. But it does raise the question of what kind of country Rwanda is really. I mean, I had a kind of vaguely positive view of the country as led by a guy who stopped the massacres of 94, the genocide, and then kind of led the country in a sort of progressively innovative direction, you know, which is a model for Africa. But then I started reading Michaela Wrong's book and other books on the topic. Michaela is a British journalist and author who spent more than two decades writing about Africa. Her postings as a journalist began in Europe and then West, Central, and Eastern Africa. She's worked for Reuters, the BBC, and the Financial Times. And before becoming a freelance writer, she's written five brilliant books about Africa, the latest about Rwanda and its murderous regime led by Paul Kagame, the darling of the West, but maybe not for much longer. Your book's been praised widely. Welcome to the show, Michaela.
Thanks very much for having me on again. I really appreciate it.
I thought it was, I've been reading the book, actually. I think it's absolutely gripping. I mean, it's beautifully written, and it's been larded with praise from people like John le Carré and Desmond Tutu, Financial Times, Newsweek. It starts off with this guy called Patrick Karegeya, which you just called Patrick, who's an intelligence chief for Rwanda, and fell afoul of Kagame and went to South Africa, and then went to this hotel to meet someone. Perhaps you can pick up the story then, because it's such a, it's like a top thriller. What happened when he went to that hotel?
It's a real life thriller with a very sad ending. Patrick Karegeya was the former head of external intelligence for the Rwandan government. He had joined the rebel movement, the RPF, when it was founded in 1990 in Uganda. He was very close to Kagame, Paul Kagame, the president. They actually went to school together. They'd joined the rebels together. They'd formed that group together. He really knew all the secrets. And what happened is, after becoming head of intelligence and moving to Rwanda, becoming a very powerful, influential man, he slowly, like a lot of people around the president, began to lose faith in Kagame, in the project, began to feel this guy is not sharing power. More and more power is being focused in his hands. We're bumping off members of the opposition. We are silencing journalists. This is not the country we fought for. You know, post-genocide, this was not the government and the system that we wanted to set up. So he became more and more confrontational, and it became clear to him, he was warned, you know, you have to leave town or you're going to be killed. So he fled the country, rebased himself in South Africa, and ended up setting up an opposition group with other members of that Tutsi, the minority Tutsi group around Kagame, had set up this opposition movement, and these were very powerful men, former head of the armed services, former ruling party secretary general, a former attorney general, began to sort of say, listen, this has to stop. Kagame is out of control. And what happened is, he was invited up to a hotel room by someone he thought was a friend, a Rwandan businessman. And it was around New Year, and he was a bit lonely. His family were in the States, went up for a drink, and never came out of that room. It was the Michelangelo Hotel, because basically a death squad that had been sent there from Kigali to ambush him. They leapt into the room, they pinned him down the bed, and they strangled him. And he died there. And it was a very shocking event. And I had, like many journalists, he was the guy who used to deal with all the journalists in Rwanda and sort of sell them the line, this sort of image of Rwanda as this progressive, you know, miracle reconstructed country that had recovered from the genocide. And I was like, geez, you know, I mean, this was the president's best friend, one of his only friends. Mm. And this is what happens to you if you stand up to power. Mm. And when I started investigating, I started talking to his family. And once I started doing that, I had been aware of some of these cases, but the other high profile attempted assassinations, the disappearances, the intimidation, the harassment, the people who get beaten up, all of this taking place outside Rwanda in countries like Belgium and here in the UK and South Africa, in Canada, in America. And just realizing that that Rwanda was actually a very rare system, a rare government, because a bit like the Israelis, a bit like the Russians, a bit like the Saudis, they send people abroad to silence critics, to intimidate the diaspora, to help create this really smooth, squeaky clean, polished, you know, image of Rwanda, because Kagame knows that, you know, he is dependent on foreign aid, and you need to have that squeaky clean reputation and that squeaky clean brand.
So how does the rest of the plot develop then? I mean, what's the sort of narrative arc?
Well, the narrative arc for me was, I sort of had always wanted to know, where did the RPF come from? Because I had known vaguely when I'd been meeting these people, because I was one of the journalists who went into Rwanda after the genocide and was speaking to all these young rebels who had sort of come in and, you know, they'd sort of put an end to the violence. And, you know, that was the way we saw them, as the people who had saved the country, ended the killings on the streets by all these Hutu extremist militias. And I was sort of thought, these people are extraordinary. They're so disciplined, they're so articulate, they're so clear in what they want to do, they're so effective. Where do they come from? So a lot of my book was to track where the RPF came from, and where it came from was the refugee camps in Uganda in particular, which had been created in the 1950s and 1960s when the royal monarchy of Rwanda was toppled and the Tutsi elite, the aristocracy, was chucked out of the country by the Hutu majority. And so what you get is this small group of people who are determined to go home. You know, there's a real exodus theme there. There are a lot of analogies with the Israel story. They want to go back, and they eventually do 30 years later. They create this tiny little secret army within the Ugandan army, and then they take all the weapons they've got access to, because they were a key part of the Ugandan military structure. They take those weapons, they take that understanding of how to fight a guerrilla war, and they invade Rwanda in 1990.
It's interesting, we're going to go into a quick news break in a short moment, but we'll just say, so basically, this elite, they're English speaking, of course, and they burst on the scene. Well, we associate it with the 94 the genocide, where there was the air crash of the sitting president, and then the RPF came on the scene and cleaned up the situation, and they're seen as the good guys. And that genocide is hugely important because we associate it with the responsibility to protect doctrine, which persuaded the West to go into other countries to prevent genocides preemptively. And of course, it's been very controversial because it's seen as just a cover for Western involvement. But we'll talk about that just very quickly after a news break. This is Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk, back in a minute or so.
I have some good news.
TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. The Australian Capital Territory government has enacted significant reforms to its jury laws in the wake of the Bruce Lehrman trial's mistrial, which was prompted by a juror's independent research. Southern Russia and northern Kazakhstan are experiencing their worst spring flooding in decades, leading to the evacuation of tens of thousands of residents as rivers burst their banks. O.J. Simpson, the controversial figure and former NFL player, has passed away at the age of 76 after a battle with cancer.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. for the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations. Vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelennero Sailor Show. We've got Michaela Wrong, a brilliant writer, award-winning, whose book, Do Not Disturb in the Rwanda, the RPF, and Paul Kagame, who turns out to be an assassin and a bad guy all round. It's called Do Not Disturb. And you threw a cat among the pigeons in a way. The RPF then came into this exodus mentality. They went back into to Rwanda. They're all English speakers, a lot of them highly disciplined. And then what happened in 1990? Let's take a history, because we associate them with the 1994 intervention, but they were there before, right? They came in 1990.
Well, this is one of the episodes that people tend to forget, because everyone thinks that the Rwandan history starts with the 94 genocide, when the plane of juvenile Habyarimana, the president, was brought down. But of course, there had been an invasion in 1990 by the RPF, and they had been gradually sort of moving towards the capital, Kigali. And there'd been, and this was very underreported. And I, as a journalist, was not really aware of this when I was reporting on the genocide. And I doubt that many of my peers were, that there was the RPF was doing its own bit of ethnic cleansing as it moved and pushing Hutus, members of the Hutu majority, out of their lands, and they were all moving south. So it helped to create this toxic climate. And people often wonder, there was a real fear in Kigali amongst members of that Hutu majority of what would happen when the RPF rebels arrived, because they'd also been, they'd seen what happened, incredible violence taking place in Burundi in a separate episode, again, by a Tutsi army. So people tend to think the genocide came out of nowhere, but it is important to realize there was a reason for the fear and hatred that led to that genocide. Mm. And, we've just recently had in Rwanda the commemoration of the 30th anniversary of the genocide. And quite rightly, people are mourning and remembering the dead who were mostly members of the Tutsi minority. But firstly, there were a lot of Hutus who also died during that slaughter by Hutu extremists. And also, we tend to completely forget about this whole build-up and the ethnic cleansing and the massacres that took place that were carried out by the RPF. So there's been a kind of, an airbrushing.
Yeah, I want to... Yeah, I mean, everything turns out to be more grey than one thinks. And the trouble is, our memories are stuck in our original headlines. And I think my theory is that almost everything we know is slightly false based on our recollection of headlines, which journalism is the first draft of history, as everyone said. And that's assuming that journalists are good faith actors, which they're not always. But even when they are, they just report, as you did for Reuters. And then the truth comes out. But by then, people have moved on. So, I mean, let's say I'm quite well versed in current affairs. I didn't know what you were, the things I had this vaguely good impression of Kagame. And I guess most people will, maybe 80 or 90%. And although your book was widely praised, I mean, no one said this is a conspiracy theory or anything. It probably hasn't penetrated. I mean, it probably needs to be mentioned in every article in Rwanda. Your book needs to be mentioned as a footnote or something, because people still have these images. So yes, I mean, I want to say, because what... I'll give you my vulgar understanding, which 98% of the population will have who interested in foreign affairs. The president of Rwanda's plane crashed in April. Was it June? I can't remember. April, I think. And then that sparked a sort of slaughter of the minority Tutsis, with the aristocratic class, as it were, the cattle farmers, cattle breeders, and then the Hutus carried out most of the massacres, and then the RPF at Kagame came in, stopped the killing, and then all was good, and then he became president. But as said, the fact is, there seems to be evidence that Kagame was behind the shooting down of the Rwandan president's plane. Well, so he's doing this to spark off. What do you think of that theory?
I was shocked because I had always read all the history books and they said, oh, it's probably the Hutu extremists. But originally there was a French investigating magistrate who didn't believe that and thought it was Kagame and his RPF. And when I started interviewing all these guys who were formerly really high up in the RPF and sort of good mates of Kagame, who'd now fallen out with him, they were all saying, but of course it was us. I mean, of course it was us. We wanted to take out the president. It meant there would be an end to the civil war. It would cause complete chaos and disarray on the other side. So of course it was us. And there was a sort of astonishment that there's somehow this weird myth had been set up that the Hutu extremists took out their own president. Mm. Now, I can't say for sure whether that's true. But these are guys who know that they might conceivably one day end up in a court of law being accused of having killed a president. So it's not really to their advantage to say this. So I ended up being convinced that it was, in fact, the RPF. Mm. But I think there's another point, which is, you know, that was a trigger for the genocide. But you also have to consider that there were what the RPF was itself doing, because there were mass slayings also by the RPF. A guy called Robert Gassoni, investigator, exposed the fact that there was ethnic cleansing in Southeast Rwanda taking place. And we all know, thanks to the UN, that there was a mass slaughter of Hutu civilians inside the forests of Congo in the late 1990s after the genocide. So, you know, it has to be nuanced. As you say, everything is grayer, and we should never sort of just look at Kagame and think this man is a hero. He has a lot of blood on his hands, and that's what I try to convey in my book. And by the way, I'm not the only person who's written a book saying that.
Yeah. There's a French-Canadian woman who believes in this theory of the double genocide, that the Hutus, and we're going to try and get some of these people on. There's a guy called Alan Esther.
Yeah, and also, you know, lots of academics also are much more nuanced in their assessment of Paul Kagame.
Okay, I'll try and get them on. And of course, Africa's World War One, as it were, in the Congo, almost like a forgotten conflict. I mean, I wonder how much percentage of the West European population has even heard about it. But that was sparked off by the Rwanda genocide. We don't have time to talk about that. We're just going to say, I mean, you've ended up screaming at night because you're so afraid of the assassination squads. And I fully understand you, given that your very detailed descriptions of the way they dispatched their other enemies. But I think we've only got a minute left. So could you just summarize? You're off to Australia next week to do some book promotion.
I've been delighted. I've been invited to give a series of talks. I'm going to be in Canberra on the 20th because there's an anniversary commemoration event. I'm also going to be talking on the outskirts of Sydney on the 21st, and Brisbane and Melbourne, and then I'm going to be going to New Zealand. And it's just a chance to get a more nuanced narrative out there, because as you say, I think people have a very simplistic understanding of what's happened. And this is the country that is always in the news, always being talked about, and it has, you know, is currently supporting a devastating rebel movement which is laying waste to eastern Congo. So we do have to understand what's going on and not have this very naive view of the regime in Kigali.
Well, I can highly recommend the book, whether you're interested in politics or just human affairs, because it's written in a very unpatronizing way and very interesting, very gripping. So Michaela Rong, I wish you best of luck on your Australia trip. And if you want to know the truth about Rwanda, do check her out, and check her out on X, and just Google it and you'll find out more. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We'll be back after the break with a second guest. Thank you very much, Michaela. Have a good time.
Thank you, Pelle. I really appreciate it.
When I had my heart event close to 4 years ago, I was at the gym, thought I deserve a coffee, and thought I'll top up with fuel. Ordered a coffee, but while I was pumping fuel, I started to get chest pains. Then it got worse and worse and worse. So then I was leaning on the counter thinking, yeah, something's not quite right. So then I went to wait for the coffee, and that's when it really, really hit. And Joy just, you know, mouthed, do you need an ambulance? And I remember nodding. I wasn't even thinking about a heart attack. I just thought, something is seriously wrong with me here. So when the cardiologist came to see me, she informed me that I'd had what they call a widowmaker heart attack. Bit of a shock when someone says, you know, you nearly died. Everybody should be aware of all the symptoms of a heart attack that women can have that aren't typical of the shoulder pain, the right arm pain. I go to the gym, I do yoga, Pilates, I swim, I go on bike rides, and yet I still had a heart attack. You just don't know, it could be you.
Around here, bushfire is just a part of life. We've been through it before, and we'll get through it again. The people here all look out for each other. We're a community that does its bit to plan and prepare, to keep everyone safe. We live with bushfire, so we live bushfire ready.
Discussing the politics of the new European populism, Pella Nuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pella Nuroth-Taylor Show. On this Friday afternoon, we've got our second guest to talk to us about what's a very hot topic at the moment, which is mental well-being and mental clarity. We've got two elderly presidential candidates, each of whom is accused by the opposition of having some mental problems or some dementia problems. And we've got severe mental health problems with regard to the terror problems that are happening in the world. Everyone is panicking over World War III, over terrorism, over the Gaza Strip, over, well, a lot of things, really. So we're going to explore these issues with Carol Lieberman, who's a board-certified psychiatrist who's been helping people cope with terrorism as the terrorist therapist since 9/11 in American and London and Paris. Her website is www.terroristtherapist.com. She's written two books about terrorism, including the five times award-winning book Lions and Tigers and Terrorists, How to Protect Your Child in a Time of Terror for Kids. That's for and their parents and teachers. She also hosts the Terrorist Therapist Show, chosen as one of the top podcasts on terrorism. And she wants, the first thing I think she wants to talk about is terrorist envy, the new psychosis after what happened in Hamas. Tell us, welcome to the show, Carol.
Thank you so much.
What is terrorist envy?
Well, first of all, the son of the Hamas leader, whose name I always have to look at it, Massab Hassan Youssef, he said that the protesters, the pro-Palestinian and pro-Hamas protesters, should get to an asylum, that they're crazy. And so I decided, you know, I mean, I agree with him, first of all. And I decided, well, if they're going to go to an asylum, they need to have a diagnosis. So I thought about it and came up with terrorist envy, similar to Freud's penis envy, which describes a stage in little girls' lives, usually 3 to 5, when they realize that they don't have a male organ and they're envious of it. It's not the organ itself that they're envious of, but rather the power. So these protesters are envious of the power of terrorists.
Mm. Well, that's interesting. So what specific incidences could you quote in let's say the United States where normal Americans or people who haven't been not usually thought of as terrorists are trying to sort of emulate in a way the shock and awe of the October 7th?
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. Well, you know, every day there's some new place where these protesters have invaded. I mean, for example, on Easter, going into St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. Actually, also at Christmas, they went to the spot Rockefeller Center where they were going to light the Christmas tree. You know, people think that terrorists are just after Jews. And yes, of course, Israel and Jews are their number one target. But really, they are about global jihad, and they're about people who are unbelievers, infidels. In other words, people who don't believe in their radical Islam. So, and then, of course, a more recent example is the protests in Dearborn, Michigan, which has been called the jihad capital of America. And death to, I mean, you know, Iran has been yelling death to America, death to Israel for a very long time. But in Dearborn, Michigan, I mean, in America, to yell death to America, it just shows how over the top and out of, I call it a psychosis, this terrorist envy, because they are so out of touch with reality, which is what a psychosis is.
Mm. And I guess, well, copycat behavior is incredibly interesting, isn't it? And how these things, I mean, it's, I guess, I wonder if Hamas had this idea on other terrorists. I mean, let's say the IRA or whatever, because it's a common, it's a historic phenomenon. And ISIS, for that matter, they do these things as propaganda of the deed. I mean, they want people to copycat and they want to sow chaos because we all run and we all live in our minds in a way. And we're social creatures and we're incredibly affected by our environments, you know, what goes wrong on around us. And I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about also, I mean, 9/11, that was your big thing that you launching this website. Can you tell us of your experiences there? Because that was hugely traumatic for Americans.
Yes, 9/11 is when I decided to do work, to become the terrorist therapist, to do work helping people cope with terrorism. And since then, I have been helping people also in England, in London, and in Paris because of their terror attacks. In fact, my first book about terrorism, Coping with Terrorism, Dreams Interrupted, was published in London, my London publisher, as the first year anniversary issue for their, in other words, their first, the first anniversary of their 7/7 attack, which is their 9/11. That is when this book came out and it was the official anniversary edition.
Do you have a list? Or maybe the trouble is with these things is that as you don't want to say too much because you want people to buy your book. But
no, I don't mind.
Can you give is there a shopping list or a list of things that people can do when there is a terror attack? What's the sort of list people can tick off to make them feel better? Their relatives or whatever, or the community or the school children, if you're a teacher, for example, because you wrote a book about it.
Well, yes, actually my second book, my more recent book called Lions and Tigers and Terrorists, Oh My, How to Protect Your Child in a Time of Terror. That's a book. The first half is for parents and teachers. And the second half is for children. It's a picture book for children about terrorism. It's like, you know, terrorism 101. And I talk about, for example, terrorists being, what is a terrorist? A terrorist is like the bully on the playground. And I do have a list. I have a list of 88 things that parents can do, or teachers for that matter, to help their kids when they're growing up to build resilience and in preparation for future terror attacks. And then also in the children's section, I give them 10 things to do that they can to prepare themselves for a terrorist attack. And these are things, you know, for the children, it can be anything from getting enough, eating nutritious food, getting vitamins, getting enough sleep, exercise. I talk about how they need to look at people, not what they look like on the outside, but what's in their heart. You know, in other words, to not have Islamophobia, and just a whole other list of other things as well. Talk about, you know, one of the important things is for not just regard to terrorism, but in general is, not watching violent movies or playing violent video games. I mean, that's what's made this whole world more violent. The exporting from, well, in America, and also the exporting of violent video games. Mainly it's more about like how to talk to your children about terrorism, how to get them to express their feelings, how the typical reactions of children are feeling sad, mad, bad.
Can I just but do you fold terrorism into the larger story of violence in general, wars, school shootings, for instance, or is terrorism somehow more different and more important to classify as a separate category of violence?
Yes, I think it's important to classify it as a separate category because it is, you know, it has its own history and its own you know, way of affecting us. And we're on the verge right now, or so the reports say, of Israel being attacked by Iran. And that is going to, if that happens, That's going to set off a whole series of things. You know, first of all, Israel will hopefully protect itself against Iran, you know, has something planned. But also it's going to set off these protesters again, you know, the pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian, pro-Iran protesters. And the real serious part of this is, well, I mean, that, of course, that's super serious. But in addition to that, there is more and more likelihood that terrorists are going to be attacking again in America. People don't want to acknowledge that, but there have been more terrorists coming in over the last, well, over years, really, but especially the last few years across the border. Biden brought in 80,000 Afghans, not all of them were good guys, you know, helping our troops because they didn't vet them. They couldn't in the chaos. And so there are these 80,000 of them spread across America. And then, you know, there are just people coming in gradually in various ways. I mean, look at the colleges, for example, with the protesters there. I mean, these are essentially terrorists. They have become terrorists. You know, they're not, they weren't necessarily trained in madrasas.
I understand, but could you just, one of the things about Bill, teaching children and young people about terrorism, I think has to be, I feel it has to be part of a larger conversation about brainwashing. I mean, both terrorists are brainwashed, you know, but I also think a lot of us are brainwashed. I mean, a majority of the population is brainwashed about COVID. I think the Swedish are brainwashed about NATO. That's my personal view. People are brainwashed about transgender issues. So it shows that we're all many of us are brainwashable, and we have to build a resilience. How would you do that? Because you've thought about these things all your life. I mean, how can you account for this transgender craze that's going on?
Yes, well, it's, I know, I was just thinking this morning again about how we have been lied to in so many ways, brainwashed, you know, and in so many different ways. It's so, and now we're going to have AI, which is going to totally destroy our sanity, whatever of it is left, because it's just, you know, everything is so confused. I mean, transgender, for example, it's so sad. It's child abuse. It is, you know, it's the idea that children before they're 18 or even in their 20s, you know, it's not children in their 20s, but I mean, you know, the parents, the idea that parents should listen to their three-year-old, you know, if their three-year-old boy picks up, tries on their mother's dress, oh, that means they must be transgender, or vice versa. It is just talking them into it. These are phases that kids go through. It's not that they really want. In fact, I was just reading a study about that, that they did a study of a bunch of, well, they started when the children were 11 and they continued into their 20s. And they found that when they were 11 and close to that, you know, preteens, they were unhappy with their gender because they felt they had low self-esteem. They felt awkward with the way their body was changing and all of that. But as they got older, they were fine with their body and who they were and what gender they were. And so, you know, this cashing in, literally cashing in on this confusion that some kids have. And of course the teachers, you know, convincing them that, oh, you feel sad. Well, just change your gender and you'll feel a lot happier. And the kids, I mean, really it's all about this oppressor and oppressee, you know, the victim and the oppressed, and that's being taught in school, whether it's CRT, critical race theory, or transgenderism. The idea is that if you join with the group that's being oppressed rather than the group that's the oppressor, then everybody's going to like you. So, of course, well, the kids are going to be convinced.
That's the whole idea about terrorists, the concept terrorist. All that's almost fallen out of fashion. But let's talk about this whole terrorist thing. I mean, would you regard the whole establishment medical profession, would you call for accepting and pushing gender change, would you call them terrorists? would you call the BLM activists who are never arrested, would you call them terrorists? Because it's a kind of below the radar terrorism that seems to have destroyed American cities. You know, should we only focus on these stock caricature terrorists, which exist as well, you know, the ones with the towel heads, whatever you call them. But I mean, should we have a much wider definition of terrorism, do you think, than
well, I mean, you can't certainly BLM were acting like terrorists, but I when I refer to terrorists, I mean, yes, you know, they terrorized America, absolutely. And still are in the form of pro-Palestinian and pro-Hamas terrorists. Basically, it's a lot of BLM people who have now transformed into those activists. But so, I mean, in some conversations, you can kind of describe them, some of the similarities and so on. But I'm talking about, I focus primarily on the radical Islamist terrorists, the terrorists who have been taught in the Middle East, in their madrasas, including Obama. You know, he wants us to think that he has forgotten his roots, but they are showing, especially now with his telling Biden what to do towards Israel and towards Jews. You know, we're seeing his anti-Semitism and his anti-Israel feelings. So but I'm talking about these radical Islam.
That's new to me that he was in a madrasa. I mean, I read one biography of him, but that's interesting. Just we've got two minutes left. So if you can tell the story about his madrasa experience, okay, That'd be really interesting.
Well, when he was growing up, he spent some years in Indonesia and he attended madrasas for 4 years. Now he poo-poos it and says, oh, well, wasn't that kind of a madrasa and all that kind of stuff. But madrasas are what teach children, starting from as toddlers, to become terrorists. They have games and songs to hate Israel and to hate Jews. They teach it to them from the very earliest time. And so that's why it's in them. You know, it what you learn as a young child is stays with you more than anything. And that is why when they attacked Israel on October 7th, it was such a brutal kind of attack, because it was in their mind, they were doing it for their God, for Allah. You know, that Allah will reward them for killing Jews and destroying Israel. So the fact that Obama has this background that he has been always trying to deny, you know, is very significant, especially now.
Okay. We've got time for one last question. So I'll say, what do you think of the mental health? I mean, you're much more experienced than the general public, or the clarity of mind. Should Biden and Trump both be standing, or should only one of them be standing, or neither be standing for election now?
Well,
when you say standing, you say running for election.
If Trump doesn't win, the United States is going to be in deep trouble. Biden, I have been talking about Biden's dementia. I called it encroaching dementia since he was first running from his basement in 2020. Trump does not have dementia. I mean, sometimes, you know, when he talks off the cuff for the most part. He's under so much stress now from all these lawsuits and so on that sometimes he'll stumble a little bit, but it's not dementia.
Good. Okay. So, Dr. Carol Lieberman, thank you very much. Very interesting discussion about mental health and the concepts of terrorism. Wish you best of luck. And you're on the website Terrorist Therapist, Terrorist the Rapist. No, terroristtherapist.com. Carol Lieberman. Check her out on Twitter. And we will wish you best of luck. And this is the Pelle Neros Taylor Show. We'll be back after a break and the news. Thank you.
Thank you.